It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We get pro tips on serving up a festive holiday meal with a Wisconsin flair, from the cheese balls to the cranberry sauce. And here's one of our favorite sides, candied southern sweet potatoes. Call in with a question. You can share your holiday cooking comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh Swanson is here, executive chef at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Josh, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
Yes, you have a tradition there, providing some home-cooked meals for students around Thanksgiving and Christmas. How is cooking a Christmas-style meal for campus different from a typical day?
Well, our normal dinner runs anywhere from 700 to 900 people. And for one of the special holiday meals, we'll see around 1,300 students. They all get pretty excited. Some of them dress up for it. They come in as early as they can. They usually form a line out the building and then rush to their tables so they can kind of claim their spot and sit with their friends where they want to and then get their multiple plates of food.
It sounds like a really special tradition there.
It's one of the most impactful things that we do with the students. We regularly survey them through different means throughout the year to kind of see if we're hitting the mark, and special holiday meals are one of the most important things to them.
Does the meal change much, whether it be in the recipes you source or in the ingredients you use?
Well, the Thanksgiving meal, you know, you've got to have turkey and mashed potatoes and stuffing and all the things, right? So that one stays a little bit more consistent as far as the main courses, but we do change. We do like an appetizer buffet that they really enjoy, so I'm usually looking to put something new in there. The Christmas meal, on the other hand, is a little bit more dessert focused. So we have a huge dessert buffet, if you would, surrounded by a Christmas tree or surrounding a Christmas tree. And they're really focused on that. We do a frost your own cookie that they really enjoy. But then that gives us a little bit more freedom with the menu. So this year we put on a Wisconsin classic. We did beef tips. And when deciding what to pair with them, I was going to originally do mashed potatoes, but we actually ended up doing like a garlic butter linguine, or fettuccine, excuse me. And the fettuccine noodle just went over crazy. We were rushing to cook more of them. They really enjoyed that. So you never know exactly what they're going to get after.
And you were kind enough to share the beef tips and mushrooms recipe with us at WPR.org/mornings. You can see that recipe. And you're using a crock pot here in this recipe. How many people does the recipe serve? Can you walk us through some of it?
So it can serve 4 to 6. And this is actually converted from the recipe that I used this past Christmas. Our team made the beef tips, but we do it a little bit differently when we're cooking for 1,300. I was asked by our staff association to make a recipe that one could do at home. And this is the one that we did. So the biggest thing about this recipe is actually browning the beef tips. So yes, it is a crock pot recipe, but you're going to want to brown the beef in batches in a pan on your stove, or you could even do it outside on a flat top grill. A lot of people have those black stones now. But you want to get a lot of color on the beef when you're doing that, because that's really what's going to make the flavor and deliciousness of the finished product. And then make sure that you deglaze that pan. You can use any kind of cooking liquid that you want, but even water just works to get that fond up when you're cooking that process. And then, you know, the slow cooker is nice because you can do this in the morning and put it on real low and come home to a nice hot meal. Something a little easier for holiday meals too, to use a slow cooker so that you're able to have things hot and ready. And when your guests arrive, you can receive them versus being stuck to the kitchen.
Yes. And that the supporting cast to those beef tips. I noticed in your cooking, you're using cremini mushrooms in your dishes. Can you talk a bit about how you decide about the mushrooms?
My preferred mushroom is just a cremini. It's readily available. Mm-hmm. It's got a little bit more of a hearty flavor than a regular button mushroom. You know, the color's nice too. So that's just kind of my go-to mushroom. I do love all mushrooms, especially getting some of the more exotic ones. I picked up a pack of maitake mushrooms from a local grocer yesterday. I'm excited to use those.
How are you going to use them?
Well, originally I was going to saute them up with some broccoli. Sure. You know, mushrooms are really, really good for you. They also kind of take that place of that savory meat, so you can decrease your protein intake a little bit. Or if you're just being kind of more planet conscious, they're a really sustainable, renewable resource. And they add to that umami flavor, not to mention just overall deliciousness.
Absolutely. Talking about cooking for the holidays, Josh Swanson with us, executive chef at St. Norbert College. You can join in with your questions as you cook your dishes. Share your comments and your traditions. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh, what makes a quality main dish for a holiday party? What makes that main dish stand out and be in the middle?
I think memory, to be honest with you. I think when you go to holiday meals, I think everybody's got some kind of a memory of an early holiday meal or one dish that a particular relative always made. I know for myself, that's prime rib or standing rib roast, if you would. My grandma grew up, not having a lot. And when she was able to afford it much later in life, she was always very excited to have a standing rib roast at dinner. So I remember being a very young chef and her asking me to prepare this rib roast. And boy, was that nerve wracking because I wanted to make sure that it was perfect. And subsequently, I've kept that tradition. I've changed it a little bit over the years. Now I use an immersion circulator, so a sous vide process to cook the prime rib. And it makes it a lot easier to bring it over to my my dad's house to finish up over there and heat up.
So when you're talking about these high quality cuts of beef or even, filet mignon, they're expensive. How do you make the meat offering go further at a holiday party?
You see a lot of like a whole roasted tenderloin or, a whole roasted prime rib where you can carve slices. So you're not cooking that like 8 ounce center cut steak and putting that on people's plates. So there is a lot of availability in this state for inexpensive tenderloin. A lot of people like that. You can get it tied from your butcher. A lot of times that comes from a cow versus a steer. And I'm a big proponent of that. It's a good cut of meat, so there's some different options that you can do to make your dollar stretch.
And how do you make your beef gravy? Because it does call in your recipe here for the crock pot beef tips for 8 cups of it.
So I didn't want to put the recipe in there because I didn't want to put people off about attempting this. I personally prefer to get some beef bones and roast them in a very hot oven until they've got a lot of color. And then that is another crock pot trick. And this works for any kind of animal that you want to make a stock out of. You just take those bones and cover them, just barely cover them in water, and then leave your crock pot on low overnight. And you will wake up to the most delicious smelling house. Full of just wonderful aromas. And then you just strain that liquid off. I like to use either cornstarch or rice flour to make a thickening method. Mm-hmm. So you can make a roux with the rice flour. It's just an equal one-to-one substitute. That's actually what we use at the college for our gluten-free roux. It's just rice flour and then butter. Or cornstarch works as well. So you could go to the store and you could buy a beef gravy if you wanted. There's several options available. Or you could buy one of the containers of like a, my last name brand, broth, right? No relation.
Your
no
other
relation.
Job, your other job, right?
Yeah. But that's the famous one, right? You could buy that and then just thicken it a little bit. Any kind of method that you prefer, cornstarch works fine. Otherwise, like I said, I like to use a gluten-free roux works well as well, which is just equal parts butter and rice flour.
One of the tensions is the oven space. How do you maximize your oven space when it seems like everything needs to go in at the same time?
Well, I just hosted Thanksgiving, so I know all too well. again, the crock pot, if you can prepare things in advance and have them hot in a crock pot, like so mashed potatoes, you can prepare 3 hours in advance and hold them in a crock pot on low, and they're not going to really depreciate in quality. So that's an easy one. Personally, what I did this year is I put the turkey in extra early, about an hour earlier than we needed to. I got it right to temp, which for me is 165 in the middle of that breast. I don't want really overcooked. So I'll pull it at like 160 and then watch that thermometer on top of the stove to make sure we get to that 165. But that results in really nice juicy turkey. But so while that was out, all the stuffing and the casseroles all went into the oven. Those all got baked. So they were coming out nice and hot, and then you just keep the cover on them and you pop that turkey back in there for about 10, 15 minutes. And that just kind of resurrects that heat in it and put it on the carving board and you're ready to go. It also helps let the juices settle in the turkey.
Yeah. So it's almost like a little bit of a finishing there. You rest it and then you put it back for the finishing.
Correct.
Yeah. De Pere-based chef Josh Swanson helping us with preparing special meals, pleasing a range of eaters. Call in with a question. You can share your holiday meal cooking tips at any point. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss cooking for the holiday season, how to create more wins in the kitchen with tips and tricks from a De Pere-based chef. And you can be part of the discussion, call in with a question, share your holiday cooking advice. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh Swanson is executive chef at St. Norbert College. Josh, let's go through the gluten-free stuffing that you've shared with us at WPR.org/mornings. We put up your recipe. Walk us through what is interesting about this gluten-free holiday stuffing.
Well, this is something that our allergen chef, David DeRoche, worked on for quite a while. We wanted an offering, but we did not want to compromise what we were serving. So it was pretty tricky. Gluten-free bread doesn't react the same way that normal bread does. So we had to search for just the right type of bread to use for this. And then, you know, you've got to gauge too what allergies you're actually facing. So at St. Norbert, we don't want to accommodate allergies. We want to include people. So that's what we try to do. If we're serving stuffing in our main area with, you know, regular bread containing gluten, we'll make sure that we have a gluten-free stuffing that's equally, if not better. So this one actually turned out really great. We use a couple different things in there. You notice the cremini mushrooms. I like that you picked up on that.
I saw the theme.
Yeah, that's something that we do there that's able to kind of boost that umami flavor. A little bit of vegetable stock in there, the herbs, and then a secret ingredient here is that coconut aminos. That's something that we use a lot over at our allergen station. I like to use different liquid aminos at home just because it's delicious. I think that's something a lot of people don't have experience with, but they should definitely have in their pantry.
Yeah, that stuck out to me. So coconut aminos, is this like a substitute for soy sauce?
Yep, you could use it as a substitute for soy sauce, but what I like to do is take it even further and work it into recipes in replace of like just using plain old boring salt. You know, it's going to add sodium, but in addition to adding sodium, it's going to add a little bit of an umami kick. So it's going to give you a more round, full flavor in your mouth.
Oh, wow. So do you serve this stuffing at the holiday meal at the college?
So we serve it for the Thanksgiving meal over at our allergen station.
Okay, yes. How do you handle a range of dietary needs or dietary preferences when creating a special meal for everyone?
So we want to just make sure that we're, again, you know, not accommodating, but rather including in our holiday meal. So we have a dedicated kitchen where we would prepare, you know, all the fixings you would normally get. We got the green beans, we got the stuffing, we got the mashed potatoes, we got roast turkey, you know, everything that you could possibly want for a holiday meal. And we actually do a little bit extra over there. Dave came up with a really nice sweet potato steak recipe for our vegans, and then he puts a little cranberry chutney on it. So that's something that's become very popular.
Sweet potato steak. How are those sweet potatoes prepared?
So you put just, you cut them in, you know, trim off any of the peel, mm-hmm. and then cut them into like a steak-like shape, if you would. So just the long way on the potato, maybe, I don't know, a half inch thick or so. We put a little bit of oil on it, and then just kind of kiss it on the grill to get nice grill marks and get some of that char flavor. And then you finish it in the oven just so it's roasted. And you got to pull them a little bit early. A lot of people are really used to sweet potatoes where they're very, very soft. Mm-hmm. These ones have just a little bit of a bite to them. I wouldn't say you bite into it and say that it was undercooked, but just enough so it holds its shape. So that's really the tricky part of it. And what our team really pays good attention to is making sure that it'll hold its shape, but it's nicely tendered and pleasing to the palate.
That's what I was wondering. Like, how do you make that hold together? Is there anything else besides the sweet potato that is kind of a bonding agent, if you will?
No, just the sweet potato, and then we just garnish it with little bit of cranberry chutney that we make in house. So there's a lot that you can do with different things, and we've learned a lot of that. Mushrooms, we make pulled pork out of a mushroom, portobello mushroom stems, and it's a little bit of a tedious process. But man, if I put barbecue sauce on it and handed you a sandwich, there's a good chance you would not know the
Couldn't.
difference.
Oh, wow. So, what are you doing with cranberries these days? Cranberry chutney there on top of the sweet potato steak. How do you use cranberries?
All different kinds of ways. We like to get them in both frozen and dried. The dried ones, I like to just reheat them a little bit. I like to put a little bit of apple cider vinegar in with them, kind of continue on that tang flavor. It's a really nice way to balance dishes. Obviously, orange is a good friend as well. So if you want to squeeze a little orange juice, maybe a little orange zest in there. I like to sneak a little clove in. It can be tricky to do that because I don't like using ground clove. It's a little lackluster for me, so I like using whole cloves. So sometimes you gotta try to put them in a little sachet, which would be a little cheesecloth bag tied up, to permeate that flavor through, but not have that whole spice in there because nobody wants to bite down on a clove, right?
No, absolutely not. We have Josh Swanson with us, executive chef at St. Norbert College, helping us with some tips for holiday cooking. And you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Okay, so Josh, when you have guests who are coming with a potluck style type dishes and everyone's bringing something to the table, where do you stand on holiday potlucks? How do you make those come together?
Our own Thanksgiving that we hosted was a bit of a potluck. We had people bringing different dishes. Some folks like to bring desserts. Some folks like to bring a salad. Some people bring a hot dish. It's great. I think it does require a good bit of coordinating at the beginning, though. You've got to communicate out to the group who's doing what so you don't end up with all salads, right? But it can be a lot of fun, and it can also share the burden on the person that's hosting. I think any of us that have hosted a larger group, it could be very trying to prepare that amount of food for that many people and have it ready and hot and delicious. So it's always helpful to have people that are coming together for a potluck. Something else I've seen in recent years is utilizing other public spaces. Last year, I actually had a Christmas party at a community center, and that was pretty neat, but it's a lot to haul in and out. So if people each bring a dish, it makes it a lot easier.
What makes cleanup easier? Do you have any advice for streamlining the cleanup process?
I do. I have some really good advice. Clean as you go. So I think Rick Bayless just came out famously and said, some things you don't have to wash, you can just rinse. And that's true. If you're cooking and as you're rolling really fast, you can, keep a dish sink rolling and give it a rinse, get in that soapy water, wash it and set it to dry right away. The more dishes that you can clean while you're cooking. And you'll often find time in between where your casserole's in the oven and you've got to wait. So clean up as much as you can beforehand. And then the other one that I've got that's a little scary this time of year with people are doing holiday meals is when you're working with proteins in your kitchen, don't forget that bleach is your friend. You can use those bleach wipes to wipe down your counter. It's great to wash everything, but sanitizing is also important.
Yeah, so keep sanitation in mind there. And this can be stressful, holiday feasts when you're cooking them up. How should guests help ensure everything goes smoothly? How can we help, especially the host?
For me personally, it's nice that everybody gravitates towards the kitchen and they want to talk to the people that are cooking. But
Oh.
everybody comes in and says, "Do you need a hand?" But what you really need is everybody to not be in the kitchen. So, my advice would be, figure out where the beverages are, grab one yourself, and go relax because that person's working very hard to ensure you're going to have a good meal. And they'll trust me; they'll let you know if they need a hand.
Well, maybe they can be in the assembly line dishwashing phase.
That never hurts. One of the coolest things I ever saw was I have a friend, and if you ever make him a meal, he insists on washing the dishes. And it's really cool and much appreciated and very helpful. Service is the best thing that you can do in my mind. Service to others is the highest purpose that you can have. So when you cook for someone, you're showing them your love. And if you jump in that dish line, that's a chef's gonna love that every time, right?
Oh, I love that. That is, and it is helpful, especially as someone has been on their feet, that host has been on their feet all day, maybe for days, trying to prepare a meal for people they haven't seen in a while, maybe, or just for a larger group. Josh, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, and all the happiest cooking in this season.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy holidays.
Yes, Josh Swanson is executive chef at St. Norbert College in De Pere. And for disclosure, St. Norbert College is one of the many business sponsors of Wisconsin Public Radio. There is more conversation ahead as we shift to baking tips and talk with the head of a French bakery in the village of Shorewood. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get just-in-time tips for holiday baking, whether we're serving up Wisconsin state pastry Kringle or building a gingerbread house, perhaps, assembling a plate of festive cookies. Call in with your question. Share your knowledge on baking. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jean Webb is owner, head baker of North Shore Boulangerie in Shorewood. Jean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's start with gingerbread. You keep a gingerbread display at your bakery over the holiday season. How is gingerbread useful for building houses and decorating?
Well, you know, the great thing about, you know, gingerbread is, if anyone who's done it, is a really robust dough, very strong. There's a lot of protein, a lot of sugar in it. So it will hold up quite a bit of weight, and it'll hold itself up. So it makes a really good architectural material as far as small structures go. So it doesn't snap really easily once it's dried, and it will hold up a fair amount of weight.
And your gingerbread display is up until next year. Can you give us a little bit of a picture in our mind's eye what it looks like?
Yeah, well, each year I let one of our pastry chefs, present. It's around July, August, present kind of ideas of what he or she would like to do. So it should be fun for the pastry chef as well as for the public. And this year, the theme that Holly Rockhill, who is the pastry chef who did it, was the Polar Express. She wanted to build scenes from the Polar Express. So this year, there's all the different scenes from the Polar Express. One of the things that I think is the cutest about this display is that in the movie, a train ticket gets caught up into a snowball and is swirling around. And now we have a big snowball with a gingerbread ticket swirling around in midair. So kind of fun.
I love that. You're really recreating such a sacred book to so many people. We have your gingerbread cookies recipe up at WPR.org/mornings. There's the cookies aspect, but you can also build, I would imagine, structures, houses from this recipe?
The structural, we use two different recipes.
You do, okay.
Because you could, with structural gingerbread, you could really do some damage to your dental work if it dries out. It's that strong. So the gingerbread cookie, gingerbread men recipe is a little bit softer.
What can you tell us about the spices you put together for the gingerbread cookies, and what stands out? I see here European style cultured butter.
Yeah, that's really, people don't, gingerbread, you're thinking about all the warm Asian spices that go into it, all those warm, you know, the cinnamon, the ginger, the cloves. But one of the secrets to baking is that cultured butter, a fermented butter. The U.S. and the U.K. have a tradition of sweet cream butter, which is unfermented. Mm-hmm. But when you get to continental Europe, it's a cultured butter made a bit similar to a process as to yogurt, but you let all the microbes ferment some of the metabolites in the butter. And when you roast that, when you cook it, those hundreds of flavor components give you this wonderful background flavor. It's an incredible palate that's subtle but kind of tickles your palate. And so you can't quite identify it because there really are hundreds and thousands of different components in a cultured butter, but it's very pleasing. And so and it's kind of that secret ingredient that a lot of French bakeries use, or most any authentic French bakery uses.
It's a foundation. It really, it is kind of like the foundation of whatever you're making. It's really, I would imagine, a really important element there and can make a difference.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's really worth the cost difference. The price difference is significant, but it really is that secret weapon. All of our baking is done with cultured butter, whereas in the cafe for kind of entrees and meals, some things are cultured butter, things are sweet cream butter just because of kind of palates and expectations. But yeah, in baking, anytime you roast or cook something, a cultured butter will always be your kind of secret weapon in your pocket.
What about shapes? What shape do you typically like to cut out for gingerbread cookies?
For us, we keep with the traditional gingerbread man. I when I was looking for cookie cutters years ago, I wanted a kind of a soft, cartoonish figure, so that it's really appealing to children. We have a little bit of a joke in the kitchen that even with that kind of soft, rounded gingerbread man shape, as opposed to kind of long extension of limbs and everything that can be a little harsher looking, you really have to be careful with how you ice them. You can get some, depending on how you put the smile on or the eyes on, you can come up with a harsher look on the cookie, which can be somewhat off-putting.
I wasn't
We
going to
have
say the word. Go ahead.
Well, we have a former pastry chef. We were testing different styles of icing, and we came up with one. And she goes, "Oh no, these look like beady-eyed little monsters. We can't put these out." And I said, "Yeah, we got to come up with different icing on this one."
Jean Webb is with us, owner, head baker of a Milwaukee area French bakery. You can join in on baked goods this season. The number to call in, 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Lou. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning and happy holidays. When I bake, because I'm plant-based, I make my cookies a substitute for egg. I do the ground flax, so I make the flag, or I use a substitute. It has a potato, it's like a potato starch, tapioca flour, that type of makeup. What else do you recommend? And I can take my answer off the air.
Lou, thank you. What about eggless baking, Jean? What would you recommend?
For structural elements, there's where ingestion, where you're not going to eat it, I'd say stay with the higher protein components, which is kind of the wheat flour, even bread flour and egg. For edible cookies, you can start to cut down on that and add those different nuts and grain-based flours. The thing to be careful of there, though, is you're going to come up with which is going to be a very nice product. It'll be very tender, but have to be a little more careful with handling the cookie because it's going to be tender enough that breakage, especially with these kind of extended shapes. So just be a little more careful with it. You can substitute lots of different nuts and oat flours and a lot of other. Any way to get the protein in that'll hold it together a little bit more, but be very careful as you're transferring cookies abound, and you can let them dry a little bit more than you would a gingerbread dough. Gingerbread cookie, if you let it dry too much, of course it'll be a little too tough. These will stay very tender. What the caller brought in, they should stay very tender for you.
Okay, let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So I have a possible suggestion for next year that I'd like to put into the offerings. How about a
Okay.
gingerbread home for how about a gingerbread home for retired gingerbread cookies?
Oh. Oh, that's so sweet. I love that idea, Marcus. Thank you. You know, it just seems too that Gina, it must take a while to come up with these concepts for what you want to make and display for the gingerbread scene.
Yeah, it's, you know, the first step is just talking through ideas where, okay, is it going to be like a movie theme or a book theme or a real world theme? Something in the news. We had one year, which I'm glad we didn't do. It could have been interesting in a fundraising sense, was to do Notre Dame after the fire.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Funds for that. In the end, we decided not to do that. The first phase is easy. It's the second phase where the pastry chef has to draw everything out to scale and cut out all the forms for all the different surfaces and put together the palette of colors that's going to hit each surface. That is a lot of work. So that's why we start in July.
That would make a lot of math as well. I mean, you really have to know what is going to be able to stand or and how the shapes are going to come together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it, often, depending on how the baking process goes, it, you know, what works out on your paper and cardboard cutouts, if you get a dough that happens to twist a little bit in the oven or shrink in a way that's a little bit different, the extension is much longer than another piece, so the contraction is greater. You end up baking a couple of times to make sure all of these pieces fit together.
Oh, my goodness. What are your go-to favorite decorations for a gingerbread house? If a family or some kids are assembling them, what are some good decorations?
Oh, there's some really fun ones. If you, maybe I can't get to them all, but one is Necco wafers. Do you remember the old New England candy company?
Yes.
Necco wafers? They make incredibly beautiful tiles for the roofs. So does Triscuits, if you want a thatched roof. Windows, a really neat trick that we've always used is if you go to a chef supply store and buy gelatin sheets as opposed to powdered gelatin.
Mm-hmm.
The sheets come in, they have this wonderful embossed pattern on it that makes it look like leaded glass windows. So it's really quite simple and easy. You open up the sheet of gelatin sheets, and then you, using icing, place it in the window, and you have this beautiful leaded glass effect. So that, and everyone always, you know, the fun part for kids often is if you want to use crushed up Jolly Ranchers to make a stained glass window. You lay your component down that has the windows in it, crush up your Jolly Ranchers, put it in the space where the window is, and then pop it in the oven and let them melt, and you get this beautiful stained glass effect.
Yes, and then if you take it out and then you start turning your tray a little bit, you can get these wonderful, like, icicle effects.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Jean Webb owns a French-style neighborhood bakery in Shorewood. Fielding questions about baking this holiday season, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with your question. You can share about baked goods. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get holiday baking inspiration from Jean Webb, owner of a French bakery in the Milwaukee area. And we hear about your favorite sweets that you serve or you gift in this festive season. Call in with a question. You can share in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jean, we're going to turn to the recipe for the Basler Leckerli Lebkuchen. And this is near and dear to my heart because Lebkuchen is something that has been served in my mom's family for so many generations. And can you talk through a bit of the recipe here? There are some things that stand out to me, but I want for you to introduce it.
Okay. You know, interestingly, Lebkuchen is probably thought to be one of the first Christmas cookies, one of the kind of these Oriental spice Christmas cookies. And it's one of my favorites too. I always upset my pastry chef as I'm trying to snitch pieces as she's trying to get her work done. So, you know, the thing with gingerbread, most of the gingerbread recipes are, is they're fairly stiff. And I think I note in the recipe kind of how to kind of help your mixer along a little bit with these really stiff recipes. But, you know, one of the great thing is about Lebkuchen is it's also the recipe I provide also has kind of a lot of orange, a lot of citrus in it, both candied and fresh zest, which really works really well with the warm gingerbread spices. The thing to be, which sometimes can scare people about this recipe, is that it is so stiff. And so you're going to get a bit of a workout, but, you know, stay with it. What we use, kind of a helpful hint is for us, at least for production, is if you have a cookie tray that is at least a half inch deep and has a vertical side to it, that'll help a lot. Don't be afraid to take a rolling pin to the dough once you into the pan. The other is really make sure you buy a good quality parchment paper, because this is a dough that will grab the paper, and it'll save you some work down the line if that paper is often you can buy what's called reusable parchment paper, which isn't quite reusable, but it's stronger and has a heavier nonstick coating on it. That'll be helpful. The other thing to be very careful of is, it's a theme through most of pastry cooking, but especially here, it's particularly important is to your moisture control. This is my pastry chefs call this recipe. If you let it cool too much and dry out too much, you basically made something that hits between asphalt and cement.
Not good.
And so once you pull it out of the oven, let it cool slightly before you glaze it, so that you kind of trap in some moisture. It's one of those cookies that has some body to it. It has all of this incredible depth of flavor. I could eat this. I have a box of it here now.
I like it because it's also a substantial cookie where, like, you know you've eaten it. Like, you don't feel like you can just keep downing them and you don't really realize what happens. I mean, it's substantial. There's that just explosion of flavor, as you eat it. I'm wondering, one ingredient that stands out here, you're adding Kirschwasser, so some like a fruit brandy as well to the recipe. Yeah.
Well, I think some of that has to do with my personal history and training. Is I trained with a lot of Alsatian bakers, and so if once you get to that part of France, which is that Alsace, Lorraine, that area that kind of jumps between France and Germany every 50 years or so, you get this wonderful tradition of two things. One is that a lot of the liquor flavoring is Kirschwasser, this fruit cherry brandy. Mm-hmm. The other is that you'll see a lot of rye flour cropping up in recipes because you're in that part of Europe. But yeah, it's not every recipe has it. It just has to be with the people I trained with. The Kirschwasser showed up a lot.
Okay, well, I'll definitely try that in our recipe as I compared our side to side. We tend to sometimes freeze ours and then put it out when some people come over. Is that, how do you feel about freezing Lebkuchen?
I think it's a great idea, actually. Okay. And again, it kind of points back to moisture control. Freezing locks in the moisture, as long as you've wrapped it up and your freezer isn't one that overly dries things. But it's a great way to hold moisture into things.
Okay, and then in terms of the glaze, what do you do there for the icing?
So what we do is we take a fondant, you can at a specialty bakery store, we make our fondant, but you can buy small packets of fondant and dilute it down with either water or milk until it's pourable and a little watery. I mean, you can spread it with a spatula, and that will set up and, again, hold that moisture into your cookie.
Okay. And, you know, in this particular mix, you've got a lot of citrus with the candied orange peel and the lemon peel, and then you've got the grated orange and the grated lemon. How do you know how to really make the balance right in the cookie with the sweetness and also kind of all that citrusy flavor that's coming together?
Well, you know, I know by reading the recipe, you would think you'd be eating you'd taste a lot of the citrus, that you get all this fruit coming through, right?
Right.
In fact, it's really a very well balanced, because you've got all of those warm spices plus a lot of the nut, the almond in there. So it's this really great balance. So it's no one flavor takes over, and so, which is really what you want it's a long tradition in French pastry, that balance, your flavor profile and your flavor balance has to be there. You have to, as they say on every internet tutorial I've ever seen so far, is you have to trust the process. I like this recipe because no one flavor dominates and you can catch them all.
Okay. So as you turn to your own home, what baked goodies will you have at your home this holiday season?
I'm a Midwestern boy, rural Midwestern boy. So it's, for myself, the holiday meal is, is my mom's meal, is what I make. It's what feels good. Even though it's a huge meal, I can go to the grocery store without a shopping list, and I don't miss a thing because I've done it so many times. It makes me feel good. And at the end of the meal, I know this will upset some of the chefs that train me. It's pumpkin pie and cherry pie and lemon pie. It's what I love.
Pumpkin, cherry, and what did you say there?
Lemon meringue.
Lemon meringue. Well, of course, lemon meringue. Oh, that is awesome. Why do you gravitate to pies? Is it just to kind of maybe get away from what you're offering at work?
Yes and no, I guess. It's one, my mom made a pie every single day.
Oh, wow.
When I grew up, my father was like big on pie, really big on pie. And so was my grandfather. So there was always pie in the house, fresh pie in the house. And so when you hit these holidays where you want to, it's about kind of cocooning and remembering and bringing all those traditions back. Yeah, you can travel all over the world and find all these wonderful culinary traditions all over the world. But on that meal, on that evening, you want to be enveloped with tradition.
So that's
where I go.
Gene, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, and happy holidays to everyone.
You too. Gene Webb, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. Earlier, we talked to Josh Swanson, executive chef at St. Norbert College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.